Welcome. You have tuned in to Progressive Radio Network, the most listened to truth radio program in the world. The title of our show is What in the Cell is Going On? And we will be on PRN.FM every Monday at 2 p.m. You can listen live or later on our vacinfo.org website or by calling 701-801-8536. My name is Renee, and my co-host, hubby, Gary, will be interviewing or discussing the gut-brain connection with Keith Bell. He is the founder of the Gut Club and has published several articles about how microbes present at time of vaccination, regulate immune response, and may be associated with adverse reaction and injury. Welcome, Keith, and please share your findings with our audience.
Thank you very much for having me, Dr. Tunsky. And Renee, I just want to ask you, what in the cell is going on?
That's right. What in the cell is going on?
That's a very cute expression you have. How long have you been using that one?
I found the answer to the unified theory about 13 years ago, when every time I studied a science, it pointed to the cell. Microbiology points to the environment of the cell. Cell physiology points to the physiology to the cell. A molecular biology points to the molecule structures to the cell. Quantum mechanics is the subatomic particles to the cell. Nutritional biochemistry is the building blocks of the cell. So I started realizing the common denominator would be the cell as far as getting sick. And when the cells malfunction, you malfunction. So this ties right into the subject matter of what you're going to talk about too, Keith, is explain to the audience, because it is a new subject matter, because it's not trained in any of the academics. And tell the audience why medical academia cannot touch this subject and go there, because it would expose what?
Well, first of all, you're right. It's not. This is not really taught yet in medical school. In fact, speaking of cellular biology, it's really taught as a sterile subject. When I realized. And then began to research that there are actually microbes doing the backstroke in the cytosol of cells, which is something like a 70 or 80% water. These microbiota of all types are actually inside the cell. They're called intracellular microbiota. And this is an area that everyone is still learning about. I still feel like a newbie and barely scratched the surface. But there are all kinds of ways that microbes are impacting the cell from the inside, and that's an amazing thing to realize. When I started out on this journey learning about vaccine safety and adverse vaccine reaction, I realized that microbes are actually regulating the response, And there's a lot of literature about how probiotics and even breastfeeding can impact the regulation of vaccine response. So there are many, many research papers by vaccine scientists. They're studying very, very much so how to improve vaccine response and efficacy and effectiveness based on microbes, because it's known that vaccines will fail when there is an imbalanced microbiota that's associated with systemic inflammation. So if you have a child or an adult, in fact, the quintessential example of this would be in the developing world. There's something called environmental enteropathy, and largely that is due to poor sanitation. People don't have toilets, or they have very contaminated water, and this is associated with growth stunting. It's a prevalent issue in the developing world, and even in Haiti, not far from where I am now in South Florida, where it's a rainy day, by the way. In Haiti, it's something on the about 1 in 3 children are actually stunted, and this is associated with cognitive deficits as well, meaning that there's a gut-brain phenomenon taking place. And what is very well known is how vaccines fail in the developing world due to this issue of imbalanced microbiota. It's also known as gut dysbiosis. And more and more, people are accepting and realizing that the gut and the brain are so connected. But this construct of how adverse vaccine reaction may be also a function of imbalanced microbiota has never been studied, or at least no study has ever been published. So, you know, and vaccine safety studies in general are hard to come by, you probably know. So, you know, this is an area where the vaccine industry just hasn't gone yet for whatever reason. You know, is it that they just haven't considered that adverse vaccine reaction may be associated with microbiota? I don't think so. I mean, I've been publishing.
If they did research it, Keith, they'd find out that vaccines belong in the garbage can. Those two words do not go together, vaccines and safe. We've been teaching forever.
What also taught, Keith, in med school and curriculum is the 70% of our gut, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, the gut is a housing for the immune system. So it's not the bone marrow. It's not the thymus. It's not the spleen. It's not the lymphatics that are important. It's the gut flora, which is what we get our terms gamma globulin, the IgM, IgA, IgE. Human immunoglobulins are actually listed with the gut, not the bone marrow, not the thymus.
And that's why we even teach that the only vaccine of our creator is breast milk.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with that. You know, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that vaccines can be effective, but they can also be a risky proposition for people with imbalanced flora. And this includes, actually, I shouldn't even say imbalanced flora, because flora balance is actually known to be different based on gender, race, geography. So, you know, so it could be that someone with any particular kind of flora balance may be at increased risk of an adverse vaccine reaction. And, you know, this could include African Americans, for instance. You know, the William S. Thompson debacle is still continuing, and to this day, there's no biological plausibility accepted for how African American boys may be at increased risk of vaccine reaction. Adverse vaccine reaction, autism associated with the MMR vaccine. Well, it just so happens that by nature, African American boys have a particular flora balance, and this flora balance may be associated with a hyperactive immune response. You know, in fact, the Mayo Clinic did a study a few years back. They were with Somalis, Somali Americans. And it was I believe it was the rubella vaccine. And they found that, you know, that the Somalis, I think their response was something like twice the antibodies compared to other populations. And they had no explanation. You know, they looked at genes mainly. But what if it's a matter of flora balance? And this all indicates to me that there should be routine stool testing, microbial DNA stool testing, which we can talk about. That's part of what the Gut Club does. On our website, thegutclub.org, we have pages pointing to our Facebook page, where and we have two different Facebook pages. One's our general page. It's very active, where we post studies and talk about general gut health issues. And another page is a closed group. We have 1,700 people now, part of this group, posting their stool test results. This is a new science. This stuff is new to everybody, such that we have doctors and health professionals on our page soaking this information up, because nobody is really a complete expert in how to interpret these stool test results. But we've been doing it, and it's pretty obvious how some people have dysbiosis and imbalance. And we connect it with certain symptoms, and then we come up with ways to balance the microbiota through diet and natural substances. So This is called the Gut Club Stool Test Discussion Group on Facebook, by the way, and everyone's invited to join us. But I think this opens up a whole new playing field that the vaccine industry really is not prepared to play yet. This is a game that they can't win at. They can't even play this game because, first of all, it's new science. And secondly, they do not want to divulge any possibility of a biological mechanism, because all of the vaccine experts will say, you know, flatly, there's no biological plausibility, but there's plenty when you look at the gut-brain axis and you look at how microbiota are regulating immune response. To me, it's the elephant in the room, and we need to get this out there.
Yeah. What kind of strains are you talking about that the human biome is made of? I know there's Acidophilus, there's Bifidus, or Bifidobacterium, there's Lactobacilli, there's Planetellium. But how many total strains that you found in your research and others have they found as far as different strains in the microbiome?
Well, there are hundreds that are examined in the stool testing. We work with a few different companies. There's Ubiome, Thrive, and several other companies where people are posting their stool test results. But in terms of vaccination, there are two ways of looking at this. The first and possibly the most important mechanism is that there are reduced or absent, completely absent or reduced levels of what we believe are protective microbiota. And those would fall mainly under three different categories, in my view: Bifidobacteria, Lactobacillus bacteria, and the commensal Clostridia. These are the Clostridium that don't have a bad reputation because largely they have no reputation. But these commensal Clostridia are responsible for producing butyrate, which is, you know, considered to run the show, including in cellular biology. So if these protective microbes are missing or reduced or absent, then that may indicate an increased risk of a vaccine injury. And when those microbes are reduced or absent, then there are overgrowths. This is the second way of looking at it. Overgrowths of certain types of bacteria, like proteobacteria and Bacteroides. These are the gram-negative bacteria that can be overgrown and lead to a hyperactive immune response. And they may, they may be associated with autoimmunity, although there are some gram-positive organisms that have been shown to be associated with autoimmunity as well. But, one of the examples I like to use when it comes to adverse vaccine reaction are preterm infants. You know, just a few short years ago, the CDC protocol was to vaccinate preterm infants as if they were full term. And that was changed because it was found that preterm infants are at increased risk of adverse vaccine reaction. Well, why is that? It just happens to be that preterm infants also have, by definition, high levels of gram-negative bacteria, including proteobacteria. And that is, the case for a few different reasons. It may be that the mother was also high in those types of bacteria. And, that's another really important area that I'd like to talk about, and that's how there's a vertical transmission. Actually, like genes, microbes are actually passed from generation to generation in the womb. The womb is not sterile as once considered. It's become a widely accepted fact that, that it's not, colonization of microbes actually begins in the womb. It's not as commonly considered a sterile place, and then colonization begins during the birthing process with vaginal flora. That's no longer the fact. There's tons of evidence saying to the contrary, that colonization actually begins in the womb. So back to preterm births, so that's one possibility, that the mother passed on an imbalanced flora to the child. And this sets up a child to an increased risk of a vaccine reaction. But another fact, and this is really interesting, I'm still learning about this, that gut microbiota assembly are actually based on gestational age. There's a distinct order for how microbes are assembling, and it begins with lactobacilli, bacillus in general, I believe, and then the next level of bacteria, the next genus to thrive would be the proteobacteria, and after that you have Clostridium flourishing. So, and antibiotics can slow this up, C-section can slow it up, but the order, is something that is set in stone. That's a fascinating thing to consider, that our families of microbes are actually, growing in an orderly fashion. Why and how that came to be is something I need to learn more about myself, and I think the world does. But the fact is there is an order. So when you have a preterm birth, you have, by definition, higher levels of proteobacteria relative to other types of bacteria that can dysregulate the immune response.
What is in the vaccines that are actually causing this symbiotic change disorder as far as how the microbes work? And what would be in the vaccine that would actually destroy the lactobacilli or destroy the bifidus or any of the bacterium that we're talking about?
Well, that's a whole another ball of wax. When you talk about vaccines actually changing the levels of flora, that's never been studied except for one paper that I've seen, the cholera vaccine. And this is something, you have to translate from, I think it's from Chinese or Japanese. There's one paper showing that the cholera vaccine significantly increased the number of gram-negative bacteria. So, so it's one thing that there is, a microbial predisposition. That's a term I like to use, microbial predisposition. That means the microbes that are present at time of vaccination. That's one thing, but it's a whole other thing to consider how the immune response can also shift the balance of microbes. It can work in both directions, and both of those areas require study. Because this is so new to everybody, I was speaking with Renee last week about this. Everyone is still learning about how important microbes are to our general health. They affect every, you couldn't even name a disease these days that has not been associated with imbalanced flora. Because the gut, they say all health begins there and all death begins in the colon. But small intestine is probably the most important area of the body. It's, when that starts to fail, I like to say it's the beginning of the end. That's where we really need our protective microbiota so that the other microbes don't overgrow. But to get to your question, what's in the vaccine that's causing the immune response? It could be the adjuvants, of course. I need to learn more about that myself.
What is in them would be what? Antibiotics. And what does antibiotics do for the gut flora? It destroys it. Heavy metals. So you got aluminum, mercury, cadmium, lead. You got polysorbate 60. You have MSG. And all of these adjuvants that you're talking about, Keith, is in some way destroying the gut flora.
And that's not even counting the mediums they're using in the laboratory to make the diseases. They're not even natural diseases from our creator. They're actually laboratory made, and they use monkey kidneys and the jugular of a horse and the aborted fetal tissue. So you're bypassing our defenses like fever, vomiting, diarrhea straight to the bloodstream, injecting, putting the immune system on red alert is what you're doing when you put it into the bloodstream like that.
That's right, but that immune system, we have to remember, is guided by the microbes that are present at the time of vaccination. So we really need to make this distinction, because most people who are vaccinated they seemingly escape injury. You know, whether it's a subtle injury is another, you know, that's for, you can put, do an entire show on that. But you know, adverse vaccine reaction is still comparatively rare. And what I think we need to do is really open up this whole new territory for people to learn about what's really running their immune system so that they can be educated about ways they can then choose not to vaccinate and concentrate on what I like to think of as real immunity. And that would be balanced microbiota that right. help our, because there's this, I think the most fascinating and exciting part of scientific research today, and there are a lot of labs doing this, one in particular, University of Chicago, they have an entire program. They just got $100 million to start this program last year. It's based on the reciprocal relationship between our microbes and our immune system, because we're in this together. And the microbes are guiding the immune response. But the immune response is also factored in keeping flora in balance. So they have this reciprocal relationship. And this, you know...
And that goes also with our nature, too, Keith. You know, you look at the trees and you look at the flowers and the soil in agriculture, and agronomists know that the bugs, the ladybugs, the aphids, the even the grasshoppers have purposes in keeping that soil cultured. So there's a symbiotic relationship of bacteria and aphid and ladybugs and so forth in the soil that protect the soil and the flowers and trees and plants and fruit and veggies, very similar to our soil in our gut. What's interesting, too, is you can drink alkaline water that's clustered or micro-clustered ionic exchange water that's alkaline and become an acidic small intestine. Well, the small intestine can be in a prime pH to culture these microbiome.
That, you know, I'm so happy you brought this up because, you know, as a profession, you know, since 1989, I've been an environmentalist, and I consider the Gut Club really a form of environmental activism, because our gut is like a garden, and the whole world, our you know, microbiota are not just about personal health; they're also about planetary health. And this, I'm not sure I mentioned this to you before our call, but I've recently published a children's book about rainmaking bacteria. Have you ever heard of rainmaking bacteria? Speaking of a rainy day, these are the bacteria that are in soil and on plants that go up into the clouds, where they have the ability to freeze the water in clouds, and that is required for it to rain or snow. So, you know, so whatever happens to microbes on the earth go up into the atmosphere. It's called the atmospheric microbiome. So we're surrounded by microbes in the atmosphere, and depending on their balance for it to rain or snow. So, you know, when I see all the news about California wildfires, wildfires now throughout the Southeast and all over the world, there have been devastating wildfires. People are not really asking why did the drought begin to make those conditions possible for these wildfires. And, you know, maybe it's our use of agricultural pesticides that have skewed the balance of microbes on land, and that is what is causing an imbalance of microbes in the clouds leading to drought.
I totally agree with you, Keith. You know, you got your NPK that's been trained by a lot of the farmers that are conventional, that are linked with Monsanto. So they run NPK, nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. But what about the other 69 minerals that are needed to keep the soil healthy? So they're missing a lot of nutrients that could culture some of these microbes that we're talking about to create a symbiotic relationship with them in the soil so that the plant doesn't die and that flourishes with the fruits and the veggies and raw nuts and seeds and so forth. So there is a direct correlation to our gut and our soil versus the flowers and the trees and the plants having their guts in the soil, and that soil keeps them alive, and that's the part of their immune system also.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, you may have seen in the news that Monsanto's name has, been folded after the Bayer takeover. Well, mm-hmm. Bayer has a program where they're trying to, they'll be marketing a program where the microbes in the soil are feeding the plants as opposed to using fertilizer. And then, that's a big problem, the over-fertilization. And this also relates to poor sanitation. There's something called nutrient pollution, where you have farm runoff and also, the wastewater treatment waste that goes back into our water supply. And this is a form of nutrient pollution, phosphorus and nitrogen, that overfeeds algae in bodies of water, turning them into low oxygen dead zones.
Right.
One of my favorite examples is my hometown of Chicago has been sued for sending their sewage down the Mississippi River, where it flows into the Gulf of Mexico, causing massive algae blooms and a big dead zone. And this is happening all over the world. Most places don't even have wastewater treatment. Raw sewage goes right into our bodies of water. We really need to figure out ways to end this, what I consider a barbaric practice of mixing waste with water, because just like our own bodies of water are experiencing imbalanced microbiota, and that's where you have a lot of gender bending happening associated with this. A lot of the fish are gender bending. For instance, in the Gulf of Mexico, I saw an article where you have, I think it was female fish growing testes in the dead zone. So it's wreaking havoc with our hormonal systems.
It is. And then based on what Dr. Suzanne Humphreys told me back in Tallahassee about a year ago, I did a radio show with her, and she informed me that in the new pneumococcal vaccine they're giving two-month-old babies, there's E. coli. So we're talking about waste in the vaccine that's going into the bloodstream.
Sure. And, of course, there have been a lot of studies about glyphosate being found in, a lot of news about glyphosate being found in vaccines. Well, that's just a very persistent chemical. I wasn't surprised to see glyphosate in vaccines because it's everywhere. It's in rainwater and rivers, and it's not going away. It's a persistent thing. And so, we're just mixing everything up, and it's the ultimate non-kosher, basically. So
right. We wonder why every other child affected, practically.
Right. And we need to learn, I think, part of what the Microbiome Vaccine Safety Project is about is, we're doing a couple different things. We're just at the beginning of our journey. We just opened up a Patreon account. If people go to thegutclub.org, you'll see on the menu at the top a link to our Patreon page. We're raising funds to conduct research at a notobiotic pig laboratory and we can talk a little bit about how this works. We're actually trying to raise $200,000 in order to do some testing on this central hypothesis, which states that the microbes present at time of vaccination may be associated with adverse vaccine reactions. So there are laboratories that have what are called notobiotic animals. Usually they're pigs or mice. We're working with a pig laboratory, and this is a very important way to demonstrate how microbes may be associated with adverse vaccine reaction, because what the science is able to do is take human microbes and implant them into sterile pigs and then conduct experiments using different types of vaccines. The lab that we're working with has done a lot of work in rotavirus vaccination, and they found that, for instance, lactobacillus are protective against injury by rotavirus, intestinal injury. and even things like rice bran, which is a prebiotic. That's a prebiotic is different than a probiotic. It's what feeds the beneficial microbes. So, you know, they've used rice bran to demonstrate a growth in lactobacillus bacteria that was protective against rotavirus. So this is something you could never do with children, although what we'd like to do as part of the project as well is work with a hospital on a routine, to demonstrate routine stool testing of infant stool and meconium, and then look at the possibilities of adverse vaccine reaction. It would take a lot, you know, to demonstrate that, because you'd probably have to have, you know, 100,000 different subjects. I mean, you'd have to have a very large base of subjects to be able to draw association. Whereas with a notobiotic pig lab, we can have four or five different categories of gut microbiota. For instance, we can have one that has the protective microbes, lactobacilli and clostridia and bifidobacteria. Bifidobacteria, I like to think of as the Rolls Royce of the microbiome. That's what flourishes with breastfeeding. So to me, I mean, some of my earlier articles beginning in 2014 focused largely on bifidobacteria and how when those are missing or reduced or absent, that might mean an increased risk of vaccine injury. So this is something that we're attempting to demonstrate with the Microbiome Vaccine Safety Project, how microbes are regulating the immune response to vaccination. But what really needs to happen is the other part of our project, which is a general education project. We need to produce videos and go out into the field and educate people about microbes in general, because most people don't really know what microbes are. I mean, and why they're so important. And, you know, to many people, it's obvious, and they've done some studying, and even to those people, it's still so new that there's so much to learn about it. But the science is overwhelming. I mean, in the last 5 years, there have been thousands and thousands of research papers put out. And based on what I've seen, it's probably some of the best science that's ever been produced. So, you know, there are some people that say, oh, we're just not there yet. We don't know enough yet about microbes to draw this conclusion. Well, we do. You know, that's the old line, you know, remembering what they were told 5 years ago. People need to get up to speed and learn about how microbes are running the show. I like to think, you know, we can all laugh about this, but I think of my own body as a walking compost heap, and it's my responsibility to keep myself in balance. So, and we all need to think of ourselves in that way, because microbes are everywhere in our bodies. I mean, and there's no privileged site. You know, people used to think the brain was sterile. No, that's not the case. There are studies now showing that, you know, that are indicating that our brain is also reliant on a balance of microbiota.
The microbiota is behind your eye, they're in your blood, you're in your intestine, they're on your fingers. So if germ theory is correct, everyone in this planet would be either dead or sick if germ theory is correct. So that's why they can't go there, Keith. In academia, you can go to Harvard, Baylor, Stanford, Loma Linda, Dartmouth, it doesn't matter. If you taught the truth that there's a symbiotic relationship of germs, then germ theory would be thrown out. And guess what happens with antibiotics? Guess what happens with antivirals? Guess what happens with antifungals? And they're all the script writing would go down the tubes. So it's a economic game of hiding truth of Louis Pasteur's germ theory. It's called monomorphism, where Staphylococcus causes staph infection, Streptococcus causes strep throat, pneumonia causes pneumonia. So the germ theory of monomorphic theory with Louis Pasteur went head-to-head with Antoine Bichat. And Antoine proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that it was polymorphic or pleomorphic, meaning many changes of the pathogens based on the cellular environment. So just like the environment of the soil, just like the environment of the gut is the answer, the cellular environment of the human body is the answer to germ theory based on whether it infects, whether it causes a mitotic activity of differentiation, meaning a lot of microbes coming in that are more virulent can only come in based on cellular environment being toxic, there's sugar laying around, the pH is acidic, immunosuppression, not correct water, blood flow problems, stagnation to the lymphs, immunosuppression combination with low oxygen. When that environment is set, then you'll see parasites, you'll see fungus, you'll see opportunistic infections of scavengers, just like you'll see the scavengers and opportunistic infections on a plant. So you'll see a withering plant. If you don't water it, if you don't change the pH, if you don't use like manure or compost to the soil, you'll see a withering plant and a withering flower. Mm-hmm. So it's the same concept as what they're taught in med school is germ theory, germs cause illness, versus the agronomists and the farmers being taught the same way with Monsanto, that you don't need the nutrients. You don't need anything beyond NPK, PK, those three nutrients. Misconception, Go ahead.
The chemicals in our world, and we live in a toxic world, are there's basically an onslaught going on against our protective microbes.
Right.
And we see it in the stool tests. People are missing the protective microbes. They're low on Acromantia. They have no levels of Lactobacillus bacteria, which have to be there to communicate with the brain through the vagus nerve and other ways. And, you know, when these microbes are missing, that's when we have overgrowth of the pathogenic microbes. And, you know, we've got to take this science out there. You know, you talk about germ theory. There's something I learned a few years ago about poliovirus and how it's and how the infectivity, replication of poliovirus depends on how it interacts with bacteria. There's one study that shows that poliovirus infectivity it went up over 500% when it was exposed to a certain kind of bacteria. So, you know, 95% of all polio is actually asymptomatic. Everyone's walking around with polio and they don't even know it. You know, my own father tells me a story of how he was in summer camp and his two tent mates contracted polio, and you know, one child's arm, you know, was basically shriveled up from poliovirus, and my dad thought he escaped polio, and he was surprised when I told him, "Dad, you had polio, but your immune system was able to handle it because you had a certain microbial predisposition that made you immune to polio." And the same kind of science is applied to HIV, but there's not one research paper that I've found yet that shows how measles interacts with bacteria. And this viral bacterial interaction is really one of the hottest areas of science, and there's a lot more we need to learn about it. I mean, what makes one child susceptible to death by measles, whereas, you know, it's largely considered a harmless disease? And, you know, that may be due to the makeup of microbes that are present at the time of infection. Because what's happening is you have viruses that are interacting with the cell wall of bacteria. It's made up of sugar. You know, that LPS is something people are familiar with. It's lipopolysaccharides. That's the cell wall of a gram-negative bacteria. It's a type of sugar. And viruses are attracted to sugar. So it was known decades ago that someone eating a high-starch, high-sugar diet might be more prone to contracting the symptoms of polio, but they didn't realize it was due to how the diet shifts flora in the wrong direction. That's, you know, the field of nutrigenomics is now just getting into how food affects microbes. And, you know, before they thought it was just the food affecting genes, but no, what's really happening is the food is affecting microbial balance, and the microbes are responsible for our genetic expression.
So, well, it's amazing you said that, because if you look at the DNA, the nucleotides on the chromosome What are they made of, Keith? They're made of mucopolysaccharides. So that would make sense that the negative expression on the gene and the chromosome would come from the microbes, because the microbes are also mucopolysaccharides. The DNA constituents are polysaccharides. So therefore, you'd have an expression, whether it's negative or positive, to the actual nucleotides, the ATGC base pairs. Boy, and that would throw off the sequencing of the three-dimensional protein fold. So you get 150 letters of ATTT, CG, CG, ATTT in triplicates, and that will be affected by the microbes, that actual pattern, and cause a mutation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. You just led me, you know, down another rabbit hole I need to dive into. And I've tried to learn about how our microbes are basically interacting with our genes. You know, they're inside the cell, and LPS is interacting with our mitochondria, and that is one route to mitochondrial, you know, dysfunction. And mitochondria themselves, of course, are considered to have been bacteria at one time, and they evolved to become part of our cell. But, you know, one example I like to consider is people that are studying autism, and they're using vancomycin and wondering how this antibiotic seems to be attenuating the autistic symptoms. And vancomycin is something that is known to be used to kill Clostridium, and Clostridium overgrowth is a part of autism. And the easy way to consider this would be that the antibiotic is killing the problem and lowering the Clostridium counts, and that this lowers the toxin levels and changes the brain. Even Clostridium, toxins are known to cause seizure, for instance, which, that's really how I got my start, is studying epilepsy. I had a dog with a seizure disorder back in 2008, and I was able to shift her gut in order to treat the problem, and was able to control her seizure disorder by treating her gut, not her brain. These days I talk to parents of children who are experiencing epilepsy, and it's a large population, and the doctors are still treating the problem from the neck up. But something like 40% of the worst cases of autism also suffer epilepsy, and seizure is such a difficult, I can't imagine the stress of having a child with the disorder after going through what I did with a dog. So anyway, this antibiotic is attenuating the symptoms, but then there's remission. And people think, oh, the Clostridium bacteria just grew back. But the way I think about it is, and I found several papers showing that the antibiotic is actually affecting the ROS production by mitochondria. And so that may be balancing the cell. It may be killing intracellular microbes. That's the reactive oxygen species, ROS. That's what mitochondria are producing when they're confronted with the antibiotic. And so if this may be changing, the way mitochondria are running the cell, and it's not just a simple matter of killing bacteria. It's how the antibiotic is driving the cell based on mitochondrial function. So have you heard about
how does that affect the adenosine triphosphate as far as the production of energy from the Krebs cycle, the mitochondria? How is the vaccines or how is the bacteria or the microbes affecting that process of the Krebs cycle, the ATP production?
That's really interesting. We should talk after the show try to see if there's a biomarker we can add to our construct for the study, using notobiotic pigs, and try to get to the bottom of that. You know, there are several other biomarkers we're looking at, things like glutamate excitotoxicity, and looking at the work of Russell Blaylock, it's very interesting how he focuses on glutamate toxicity in the brain, and he's probably now more than ever factoring the gut as well. But years ago it was all from the neck up. But glutamate levels and glutamate excitotoxicity is, in my view, driven by the gut, you know, things like nitric oxide of gut origin. And you know, we have a long list of biomarkers that we're putting together for our study. But we're just at the beginning of this process, and we need to raise $200,000 to conduct the research, and that will give us the preliminary data that we need to be able to apply for NIH funding for a full study that generally can cost about $500,000. So you can see why this has never been done. First of all, you know, scientists, first, they may never have even considered the construct, the hypothesis, but also, if they did, they may be afraid to conduct the research because this may jeopardize, you know, their future funding, because, you know, they don't want to leave the door ajar for any reason to give people, you know, an understanding as to how the vaccines are actually leading to adverse reaction. You know, people like Peter Hotez, you may be familiar with him. He's one of the leaders of the, you know, of the pro-vaccine movements. He's come right out and said there's no biological plausibility, but there's plenty, and he won't talk about it. We need to talk.
Anybody that does talk about it, like Dr. Wakefield, the first one that started listening to us parents, as soon as he just mentioned the, you know, just a possible suggestion, we want to look into it, you know, type of thing. His paper was released in 1999. He lost all funding. And the nonprofit that I had in honor of my baby girl, Casey's Quest, is the Florida chapter, but the Autism Autoimmunity Project, we were one of the only independent, you know, nonprofits funding the independent researchers. So there is, you know, the powers that be, they will never fund a study that indicates vaccines have any type of role, especially with the autism epidemic of almost every other child today.
Yeah. Well, you know what? For that matter, even the anti-vaccine movement, they don't necessarily like this hypothesis either, because they want to view the vaccines as the sole culprit, and, you know, and that's not the way this hypothesis works. Well, you know, this is an environmental issue, and we all need to come to terms with the fact that someone may be born imbalanced, and then they're hit with a vaccine, and because of this imbalance, it leads to an injury. So, you know, so there are many people in the you know, anti-vaccine movement that would not want to admit that. They want to think that the vaccines are completely responsible. So I think that this construct can work in both directions and really open up an entirely new playing field for people to understand the immune system and be able to choose not to vaccinate based on real immunity and focus on what's real, and that is microbial balance. And so this, I like to think that it changes everything.
Absolutely. And there's generational, I'll make it clear in my presentation, there's generational vaccine damage. We've been vaccinating since the late 1700s. So, I mean, our creator's perfect. You can't perfect perfection. He makes our bodies perfect. It's when man tries to play the role of our creator that things get messed up here. So being that, you know, they've been vaccinating since Jenner, you know, late 1700s, and then our, you know, not only our, you know, our parents, but our grandparents, our great-grandparents, they've been poisoning us for a long time now, which is going to cause havoc to the immune system.
Yes, and I agree. It is generational, and you know, we have microbes that are probably causing generational problems based on how they are responsible for the genetic settings. So not just you know, the microbes are actually changing the settings of our genes, and those settings then are passed on to the next generation. So,
there's a science that I want the audience to look into. It's called epigenetics. It's not genetics. It's epigenetics. Mm-hmm. And Bill, there's a brilliant PhD who has a book called The Biology of Belief. And that book will actually explain to you it's the negative expressions on the gene, which the microbe would have a huge factor in as far as expressing that chromosome or that gene negatively. But we have to look at the big picture too, Keith, and the audience, that it's not just the microbes that are imbalanced. It's not just the mercury. It's not just the aluminum in the vaccines. It's not just the antibiotics in the vaccines killing off the microbes, causing a disorder of the symbiotic relationship. It's not just the polysorbate 60 and the MSG injected in you and phosphates and Roundup and erythromycin and on and on. So it's a combination of combining these toxic adjuvants, killing off the microbial flora and causing a disbalance in the gene, the biome, human biome. And that would be the factor of showing that the vaccines belong in the garbage can, because there's nothing in them that can work. You can't inject mercury and aluminum and toxic adjuvants without destruction of the mitochondria. You cannot put in the vaccines things that will kill the microbes that are going to cause a disbalance in the gut flora. So there's nothing in the vaccines that can work, nothing. It's like taking plutonium shots and saying, I'm going to cure your cancer. Well, yeah, plutonium, I'm sure, can kill tumors, but it's going to kill you too. Yeah, so the killing of the vaccine adjuvants and the RNA, DNA that's mutant, that's an actual hybrid, recombinant, recombined, combination with those toxic adjuvants shot in your blood and bypassing the nose and the mouth, can do nothing but cause illness, nothing but cause illness. You can't build the immunity with even a clean vaccine. Let's say that's not even messing up the microbes. If you take out the mercury and you take out the aluminum, well, you still have toxic adjuvants. It doesn't matter. So the drug companies are never going to take out mercury and take off these adjuvants because they're cheap. They're inexpensive to the point where they have to have a adjuvant to be a disinfectant from the witch's brew that they create in the vaccine manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. People are realizing this, and they're choosing not to vaccinate, but they don't necessarily understand, you know, the mechanism. And I think once we do understand that mechanism, it just gives us more credence to choose not to vaccinate. And, you know, I was reading recently about Italy. I think there have been like 5,000 cases of measles in Italy this year alone. It's surpassed all of last year already. And then I saw a fact. The median age of the person with measles is 27 years old in Italy. Were these people vaccinated 27 years ago in Italy?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I need to look further into this. But the point is, you know, there people are willing to risk measles and not vaccinate.
Right. And
when they're not even deadly diseases. I mean, most of our parents had measles, mumps, and rubella. Chicken pox, most of us had. It's not a deadly disease. And that's kind of what I show in my presentation, too, is how these diseases, they're not deadly that they're vaccinated for. But, of course, they – and when you look at the chart, they're coming down because of better sanitation and nutrition way before the introduction of the vaccination. So it's just – it's crazy how the drug companies use fear, you know, fear to get us to move to vaccinate our babies.
Right, and sanitation is the key, obviously, and that's really where I started my journey as well, is in the field of sanitation. That's where we need to focus. When you look at the Gates Foundation, you know, they're doing a lot of great work in sanitation, but it's still something less than 2% of their entire budget, and the lion's share is going toward vaccination. We need to start putting focus on sanitation and less toxicity in our world to improve the health of everybody. That's what's going to change things. And then nutrition. We're learning so much about nutrition as well. You know, there have been so many diets in our lifetime alone, and people now have a better handle on how diets are affecting flora balance, which, you know, can cause weight loss or weight gain depending on microbes present. And things like the ketogenic diet have been very useful for, you know, decades now in attenuating epilepsy. And we're starting now to really do the science showing that it's not really about ketones. It's about how the diet shifts microbial populations that cause changes in the brain. It's a gut-brain phenomena. So, you know, I like to think that the ketogenic diet itself is a misnomer. We need to rename that diet to factor microbiota, and you know, and especially things like reducing carbohydrate intake may be more important than increasing fat in the diet. Just reducing carbs alone shifts our microbiota populations largely. And depending on the baseline, depending on a person's microbial predisposition, for some people, it may be better to just eat meat. You know, the red meat is vilified in some circles, but, you know, an all-meat diet might serve someone well as a therapeutic diet, not something long-term necessarily, because it would end up starving the beneficial microbes. But each diet, whether it's low-carb or even a high-carb diet, is needed for some people, depending on the type of carbohydrate and the prebiotic aspect of it. So if we can just focus on microbial balance as the end point, we're going to take health a long way.
Yep, and keep it basic. Go back to the Garden of Eden, the raw nuts, the raw foods, the juicing. This is how we see many, many people get their health back. We are out of time now, Keith, and we appreciate you dearly for your information and your research, and we'll keep you in our prayers for sure. For the audience, we would like to know that all of our shows can be accessed on our website, vacinfo.org. V as in Victor, ACINFO.org. We're on every Monday at 2 p.m. Our contact number is 800-939-8227 for any questions. We thank Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, for allowing us to share this very important information. And everyone have a wonderful day.
Thanks.